Hello and welcome to the Happy Hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and joining me today, as usual, is Clark Price and Alex Cortez. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing excellent, man. Thank you for asking, and hello, everyone.
Yeah, and I think Clark here temporarily dropped out. We'll probably have him back.
I'm here.
Okay, you're here. You're moderately silent.
I was trying to be subdued because I don't want to over dominate the conversation.
Well, you know, that's okay. We have quite a bit of time, and sometimes I'll rein us back in.
I'm gonna stretch it out. Relax. Go on.
Well, you know, like your vehicle is not a stretch limo, so I don't know how far you can stretch in there. But
okay,
at least we are not stretching the truth when we're going to start talking about the Delta variant and the coronavirus. The Delta variant, there is very serious data out there right now. There is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. As CDC Director Dr. Walensky has said, is raging through the counties, is raging through the state, is raging through the nation. And the numbers are not particularly good. If we take a look at some of the current COVID tracking data, if I take a look at the case count today, the as of today, which is Tuesday, when they release all the data from the California Department of Public Health, we have new cases, 8.1 new cases per 100,000. Deaths are still flat, relatively at a low rate, but
for now
we do know that it does increase, right, Alex? And the test positivity is now at 4.5%, which would put California in the red tier under the previous tier system. So it's something to kind of really watch out. I think statewide, we're looking at some really bad data that's kind of coming out with the recent surge.
Really good data showing really bad outcomes.
Yeah. At June 15th, when the state reopened, we had a case positivity rate of under 1%. Since then, it has drastically increased four times to about 4%. It looks like it's beginning to plateau a little bit, but go ahead, Alex.
Can I pause for a second? So I think we should juxtapose what's happening during this time. So when that case positivity was that low, a lot of businesses were still closed. A lot of places were still wearing masks. And the vaccine, I mean the rate at which people were getting vaccinated was rising incrementally. Now, a lot of things have gone to the wayside. More things are open. So I think it helps to put a context of what's happening in real time as you reach these milestones and you see these numbers trend one particular direction.
Right. We also had the ending of the mask mandate as well, except in LA County, where it's been reimposed this last weekend, this past Saturday. So I think there's a lot of interesting sort of data trends that have kind of come out of this. Now, equally disturbing is the vaccination rate within the state of California. Which has kind of topped out around 60 some odd percent or nearly 60% when we're talking fully vaccinated for the state of California. If I zoom in here, I'm using the LHJ vaccine equity performance by California Open Data. It's a Tableau dashboard. I recommend people take a look at it. But if you take a look at the zip code that, you know, where our station is located, where UC Riverside is located, only 47% of the people who live in and around the University of California, Riverside, are fully vaccinated. So that is a very worrying number, because to reach herd immunity, we theoretically need about 70, possibly 80% of the population to be vaccinated. And that is a dangerously low number around the university. This is some of the surrounding zip codes around UCR are a little bit higher in the 50s. But it's a shockingly low rate in most of Riverside County.
I'm really curious as to who these individuals are. I mean, it's, at the moment, there's not a the usual high number of students living in the area. And I think the students are been pretty diligent about getting vaccinated for a number of reasons. But so it's probably not them that are showing up in the data, driving these numbers up, because a lot of them are not back. We're poised to have close to 20,000 of them back in just 2 months away. So this 40% really reflects probably some of those residents that have been longer entrenched and have at least 60% of them are hesitant to get a vaccine.
Yeah.
What do you think about that data?
Well, I mean, it's incomplete, and we know we have a very mobile population. But if you take a larger body, say like the county as a whole, which is roughly just around 50%, that's still pretty bad. You need to be higher than that in order to be able to have herd immunity. You know, there are counties in California. If you go to the Bay Area counties, for example, San Francisco County is at about 80% of its residents are fully vaccinated, so they have local herd immunity, right? Just by dint of the vaccine. Same thing with most of the 7 or 8 Bay Area counties where people have got, you know.
I mean, you're a data guy, Tony, and you have access to this kind of information. Have you pulled up the numbers to see if those numbers in these counties, these areas, municipalities mirror the registration?
Oh, of course.
Voter registration information.
Except in LA County, right?
It's a big predictor. But.
Right. Except in LA County, right? Because LA County is, I think, number one big. But there are also pockets, I think, of socioeconomic differences that are different. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking the Black and Brown communities. I think we're making headway in Black and Brown communities, because I think the Delta variant is definitely scaring people into taking the shots. That's happening in those communities as well. So I think the vaccine hesitancy is greatly reduced. But you're right. I mean, if you take a look at the political landscape, the counties, if you do county by county, the counties that voted more heavily for Joe Biden are the counties that have the highest vaccination rates in the state of California. The counties that did not have the lower vaccination rates in California,
yeah.
with the exception of LA, right? Because LA, I think, is really big. It's really diverse. And there are pockets, particularly in those communities, right?
And Tony, to go back to your earlier point, I think these gains that we're starting to see in the particular Latino population, I can see it. I mean, I watch Spanish programming from time to time and listen to Spanish radio, and there's ads urging people to get vaccinated. So, which you don't see as prevalent in the English speaking community, at least the programming, I should say.
Yeah, no, I think we're beginning to see it. I mean, if you take a look at the LA County map, right, it's really the heart of Long Beach. That's where it's problematic, you know, where the vaccination rates are lower. Once you get out to the western part of LA County, which is out to like Thousand Oaks, you know, Tujunga, not everyone lives there, so there's probably some issues.
Well, I'll give my gratuitous public service announcement. Go get a vaccine. Go get vaccinated.
Yes. I mean, that's...
I mean, the
go ahead, Alex.
What we're seeing here is basically still down to... If you're immune, I mean, you see the spread of the virus in those folks that are not immune to it, hence vaccinated, so... all these rises in cases and as a result of those folks that are not vaccinated, just like what we saw before there was a vaccine available, when not many people were immune to this.
Right. I mean, the pandemic never went away for the people who were unvaccinated. Right. And that's why I think Dr. Walensky has kind of said, we have this epidemic of the unvaccinated, And you know, if you take a look at the LA County map, it's a little bit it's political, because you can kind of see the areas that would lean a little bit more conservative are the areas where there are lower vaccination rates. I mean, we're talking like, you know, you're going out to Lancaster and Palmdale. You know, if you go out to Lancaster and Palmdale, you're talking about 46% vaccination rate, 44% vaccination rate, right? And really, that's why the mask order is in place in LA, in LA County. It's not because of, you know, Westwood, you know, Santa Monica, you know, Redondo Beach, you know, it's Palmdale, it's Atwater, it's the northern part of the county that I think is most vulnerable at this point. You don't want a replay of the surge that we saw this fall increase, into the winter surges that we say, but it's going to be inevitable. I mean, right now during the summer, that's when, you know, the coronavirus has more difficulties in propagating, right, Alex? I mean, it doesn't like UV.
Right. It's warmer. Folks are outside more often. Sun's more prevalent. It's a little drier. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of factors that contribute to it. It's how likely you are to be exposed to it, and how the relative ease of which you can be, it can be spread amongst the population.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. There's a huge danger in here once we go inside into the winter months of when people are not vaccinated. I mean, just to kind of add to you know, the sort of information that we have here. I'm here on the California COVID assessment tool. You can access that publicly. But if we take a look at the short-term forecast through the middle of August, there looks like there will be a steady decline from where we're at today, where our hospitalizations are. So we're at about 2013 hospitalizations using actual hospital data today for COVID. The models, if you aggregate them all, will say that we're at 2076, but we're already pretty close to that number today. We don't know what it's going to look like in a couple of weeks. Depending on how aggressive the model is, it can be anywhere from, we could have 3,000 hospitalizations a day up to, you know, 10,000, depending on like how badly we're going to allow this to spread. Particularly bad is going to be the ICU totals, which were projected by August 20th, to have double the ICU, the number of people in the ICUs, you know?
And I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I think there's a alarming trend that seems to be happening, and that is there's a lot of younger people contracting it and getting sick from it.
Yeah, the age band.
I mean, contracting is one thing. I mean, people can get infected, but to clarify that point, you know, to actually develop disease from it, the more harmful or potentially dangerous symptoms. That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, I think it's still not looking great. I mean, even in the most heavily vaccinated sort of the larger Bay Area local health officer region, I mean, it's still looking bad. I mean, they're looking at a hospitalization by the middle of August to go up from what it is today, about 350, up to, you know, up to five times that, about 1300, 1400, by the middle of August. So we're starting to see people starting to get back into the hospitals again with that, and which is not good. The number of deaths won't be as bad, because I think the population is different. Most of the older people have been inoculated, but deaths will follow, and it's not going to be pretty with that. And I think it's not going to be pretty, man.
Well, and I think I think what you're driving at, I'd speculate, is if we start seeing more deaths with among younger people, that tends to have a different psychological impact.
Right.
When you start seeing children and adolescents to come to this.
Right. And Clark, we want to get your take on this. But there's the fact that this is, I want to first start with Alex, because I think there's a good thing that we should talk a little bit about the science and the disease about this. But I mean, we've basically driven this virus away from old people and people wearing masks, by all the public health measures that we've been using, and of course the vaccine. So its host is most likely going to be younger people who haven't taken the shot, and children, right, Alex?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that because of, you know, selection pressures, maybe you see things that are more virulent begin to emerge, because that's what the virus has to be able to transmitted.
And I just want to I have the data now on this Southern California hospital sort of projections. We're talking about three times the number of hospitalizations. Today, the number of COVID hospitalizations is about 1,100 throughout the Southern California region. Is projected by August 15th to be at 3,300. And ICU patients are supposed to increase from, you know, 200 and triple to about 670. So, and of course, the deaths will rise as a result of all of that. And so I think it's, and there's some grim news with that Delta variant out there. And I'm with you, Alex. The best thing we can do is take the shot. Take the shot.
Yeah, Clark, well, take the shot and, you know, wear your masks. I mean,
yeah.
If you haven't, you know, definitely you want, if you're not going to get the shot, you should be wearing a mask.
Clark, what do you think about all this news? You know, we're in the middle of this surge. Doesn't look great. You know?
Well, I continue to be appalled at how, and this is as a white person, I can go and say this once again, that the Republican Party is like a death cult, because they could have gotten in front of the vaccine and said, look, we're doing this. We're putting this out there and it's going to save lives and it's going to be good for you. We're going to bring the economy back. But no, they had to associate themselves with the most preposterous, paranoid conspiracy theories, including it's all about controlling you and all of this other stuff. And actually nothing, there is nothing good at all about anything the Republican Party has done with respect to this. And I just saw another appalling exchange with Anthony Fauci, who is absolutely vilified on Fox News and throughout the Republican Party. And I know a lunatic, a Republican guy who calls me up and says Fauci is horrible and all this other stuff. Around the world, Anthony Fauci is regarded with the utmost respect as one of the top authorities in epidemiology, in the science of the virus and how virus, and not just recently, most people don't know him. This goes back to the 1980s, where he's probably saved millions of lives with his pushing treatments for AIDS and everything else that's come down that has been able to infect people in the form of a virus. There is probably no one in the world who is more respected than him. And here's this dimbulb, Rand Paul, who is actually just, I actually thought maybe years ago that, you know, I thought Ron Paul, okay, he's raising some valid points and as a libertarian, and his son is kind of carrying it on. Rand Paul has become one of the most craven nitwits in the field of American politics, and he begins this pompous exchange with Fauci by saying, let me remind you, it is a crime to lie to Congress, as if Fauci is lying and he's the standard bearer of honesty and truth. And then everything he says is nuts. He says it's all about a gain of function, which he implies is the weaponization of the virus. And Fauci just takes him apart and said, if anyone is lying here, it is you. And I'm glad he finally just let's stop being playing a game of politesse with this nonsense and idiocy and BS that the Republicans are putting out. It's really, it's like Biden said, perhaps a little imprecisely about Facebook was killing people. Actually, a handful of conspiracy mongers on Facebook are doing that, and Facebook, allowed it until they stopped allowing it, and hopefully in every case, but maybe not. Anyway, but in fact, the Republican Party is killing people, and who are they killing? Republicans.
Right. I mean, it's like I said, it's the definition of a death cult. I mean, I don't know. Mitch McConnell, who survived polio, says get the shot, right? And increasingly, even the Republican leaders, some of the governors in the state who are witnessing the impact of this are like, get the vaccine. But Fox News doesn't want to like get away from it. And I can't tell.
There was a professor at UCR who will go nameless and is a very good person. Jokingly, or maybe only half jokingly, called me up last week and said, I'm just so tired of what these guys are doing that I'm thinking, okay, if that's what you want, then let Darwin have his way with you. You don't want to take the vaccine. You want to die. Then it's a human tragedy, but go ahead. Don't take the vaccine.
Well, it's consistent.
I'm tired of it. Go ahead, Alex.
I want to echo those sentiments at times, but the truth is there's still a lot of people that would like to be vaccinated that just haven't had the chance yet. And it's disproportionately people that are.
I do have Republican friends, and some of them are pretty hardcore Republican. And people are complicated. So I have a friend who is a Mexican, and he just loves Donald Trump. And I said, it is unfortunate that these things that you say, and he thinks the virus is a fake, and I'm afraid that you actually believe them, and I'm sorry that you do. You know, I know a lot of people who wish that they'd had the virus or had the vaccine. I know a very good friend of mine from a long time. He died from COVID, and he didn't get the vaccine. They hadn't developed the vaccine. He did have another issue that affected his health that made him weak. And so he died. But accidents and fate, that's one thing. But willful ignorance that you're choosing to put yourself and your family at risk, that's another thing. That's a very bad thing. And so I said, man, I like you as a human being. I disagree with you. Please take the vaccine. Please, because there's a lot of potential human suffering that you will experience if you don't. And so I implored him to take it. You know, I heard a virologist say the other day that this Delta variant, if you get it, this will probably be the worst thing that happens to you in your life. It is that bad. You know, these people who have not gotten the vaccine have allowed the virus to replicate, because you're not stopping it. And that process of replication allows the virus to mutate and evolve and evolve. And
inherently, the mutation is going to lead to this new novel trait that makes it more just deadlier. I mean, it's In this particular case, that's what it refers to.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
but more broadly speaking, it just means to have acquired each trade.
Well, actually, what Rand Paul is implying is that the gain of function was intentional.
Right. By the whole the Chinese
labs. That U.S. money. Research dollars were actually spent on developing it, fine-tuning this virus to be more deadly.
That's right. But what's happening?
Pretty much the same.
What's happening is the gain of function is taking place because the Republican Party is not pushing vaccination, and therefore it's replicating, evolving, and mutating.
Right.
He's responsible for the gain of function.
Right. That's exactly what I was trying to point at is that this is irresponsible because we're making the virus more. We're buying the virus time to overcome masks, to overcome the vaccine, you know, and it's ridiculous how we are not taking care of.
Well, just to put a finer point on it, the Delta variant is more powerful and more transmissible. It has not defeated the vaccine because the vaccine targets the spike protein. And without that, it cannot get into the cells in order to replicate.
Right.
But something, it could evolve so that it doesn't need the spike protein.
Well, I mean, let's hope not. I mean, we'll see how this goes. But I think it is this is the potentially the craziest thing that's kind of happening in the background because it's definitely something that I think we need to keep an eye on. There's also the Lambda variant that's out there now too. That doesn't seem to compete as well as this Delta variant. But it is very, very disconcerting, and it is very worrying to have that. And so I think the most important thing, and you know, the show has become a PSA, but please get your shot. Right, Alex?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I can't say anything more than that.
Just try to be respectful of other individuals. If you're traveling outside of your municipality and they have different guidelines, I mean, adhere to them.
Right. And I think, Alex, you also had brought up a point earlier that I want to go back to, which is that not all communities have received an equal opportunity at getting the vaccine, right? At first, there was these mass vaccination clinics. You had to drive to them. You had to get to them. That required transportation. That required being able to navigate computer systems, right? There is a digital divide. There's right. Health equity issues. And, you know, you were saying that now really that in particular with the Latino community, what's happening?
You know. Well, I mean, what I referenced earlier is that I'm hearing commercials or seeing commercials on TV where they're advocating for getting the vaccine, and they're definitely more direct to the point. It's like get the vaccine and prevent others from, you know, getting ill.
It
plays more into the collectivism that you see in those typical of some Latino communities.
Yeah, I think those efforts, you know, even though they're being decried as government overreach for people to go door to door to start giving out vaccines, that's the only way we're going to do it. What has been shocking, gentlemen, this last week has been the announcement. Canada was so far behind the United States in vaccination at the beginning of this because they were further behind the line in getting vaccines. Canada has now overtaken the United States in its vaccination rates. And so it is, in my opinion, safer to be in Canada with all the restrictions and protocols still kind of in place in Canada, but with a society of much less vaccine hesitancy than to be here. That's in the United States, right?
That's the key.
Right. They're not – Canadians are not as hesitant. You were saying, Alex?
Yeah. No, I'm echoing what you said. It's these It's this hesitancy, and rather not just folks being hesitant, but how different groups and particularly certain news outlets have found a way to coerce people into believing that this is something that is bad for them, and getting a vaccine is counterproductive to their health. There's a driving force behind this hesitancy. It's not just a matter of choice.
Right.
There's a propaganda by a certain news network and some other tangentially related faces in the internet.
Yeah, no, I find it fascinating. It'll be interesting to book for someone to write in about 20 years about how our country went from a post World War II era when we developed the polio vaccine. Everybody thought it was their social responsibility to do that, to end the scourge of polio, to end the scourge of all these diseases in the 50s and 60s, to now a society that even in the face of a global pandemic is willing to die because of rumor and of choice and hesitancy. I think it's something very interesting. I don't know what to make of it. It's an interesting psychological phenomenon. It's probably a little bit political on top of everything, but it's very, very interesting. But I want to move on to what I think.
What about the Olympics? Let's talk about the issue.
Let's talk about the Olympics. I mean, we're holding an Olympics while cases are spiking in Japan to 6-month highs in Japan, and there are massive protests going on in Japan over why are you holding the Olympic Games? And mind you, they're holding the Olympic Games without fans. So what did you guys think about that?
Well, I think the athletes deserve the opportunity to compete, and I mean, they've trained for this, but at the same time, I mean, the experience is just feels different. I don't know that people can have the same, I guess, psychological investment in competing in an empty stadium.
Well, yeah. I mean, you compare that with the recent NBA finals where we had like a full packed stadium. I mean, there were 80,000 people there in Milwaukee last night for the championship. And then we saw that, and that was kind of crazy and raucous too. There were no fans at the U.S. women's soccer match, which they lost 3-0, by the way, which was pretty shocking. But
I stayed up to watch that game, and it was pretty sad to watch.
It's weird.
I mean, I think part of it was maybe it was the lack of fans being there. And I mean, for these women who've had a very strong following, fan following, maybe there was something to that.
Yeah. And, you know, my thing is, I think, Alex, as we're talking about this, the thing that we should probably continue discussing about this is like, should we even have these Olympics? I mean, I think there's a place for the athletes, but it's such an altered experience. Is it worth it, you think?
It's too early for me to figure out. I think we just have to let it happen now and see what comes out from it.
Yeah. The interesting thing is the Japanese don't even want it. You know, I mean, Tokyo is under a state of emergency. You know, there are protesters saying, why are we holding this? Why are we introducing this?
I think that we should hold the games because they've done all the planning. And so and there's been all of the preparation. So just go ahead and complete them so that the athletes can compete at their peak. After all of this practice and this focus, we cannot let them be defeated in the games. They need to actually do them. And so I say go ahead and have the competition, record the winners and the losers, but we cannot cancel the games because then it is a betrayal of these athletes.
I think it parallels. I see a lot of parallels to online education and or having to do all of last year online.
Exactly, I agree completely. We did what we had to do to make it work.
And boy, that was a heavy mental toll.
Well, I think that's the heavy mental toll that the athletes are experiencing. I mean, take a look at the U.S. women's soccer team. I mean, that's just I think it's going to be weird. It's like the NBA when we saw it in the bubble last year. It's going to be weird. It's going to feel not normal. And maybe that makes for more entertaining watching. I don't know. I am more in the camp of like, yes, I understand that as long as you're willing to tolerate the economic losses, we can still do this. But it's still probably not the idea I would go with from a public health standpoint, but that's just me. And so I think the games will go on. They'll be interesting to watch. I will watch them as well, but there will be no crowd noise. You know, it won't be the spectacle that we normally see. And to me, that's a little bit sad. But it's also a marker of these particular games and of these particular times. So
a gold medal is a gold medal. And this is the athletes that have trained need to be able to compete and win or lose. And that's what it's about. And let the games go on.
I think that's a fair enough sentiment. I think you guys have laid out your points very well, at least convincingly enough to not oppose it any more vociferously than sort of out of my public health concerns. The other interesting thing that happened this last week was Jeff Bezos following Richard Branson last week going into space with his rather interestingly shaped rocket. Particularly Bezos'
Austin Powers.
From Austin Powers.
It's the same prototype, right?
Right. It may be the same prototype. But what did you guys think of him and Branson, these billionaires blasting off into space?
Let's start with you, Alex. You have people that have some real power and a lot of money to actually do a lot of public good. And what is the first thing you do is fly away from these problems that exist here on Earth? I mean, what kind of message does that send?
Right. How about you, Clark?
Well, years ago, because I'm older and I'm a jazz fan, I used to go to shows by Gil Scott-Heron, and associated with a group called The Last Poets, he did a great track called Whitey on the Moon. And I can't remember the lyrics, but they were brilliant. But it was my little sister is ill, and all this other stuff is happening, and then Whitey's on the moon, and then there's another stanza of this deprivation is taking place, and that life is going unfulfilled, and this disease is happening, and still Whitey's on the moon. So I did think about that, about not addressing the here and nows of our situation on planet Earth, and instead looking outward. But I have to also say, although Alex is billed as the science guy on the show, I've been focused on science my whole life. And I think this is important work at the same time. And I don't think it's a zero-sum game. We can do both. We need to explore. And ever since Trump came in, NASA's budget has been cut. And we have not been doing the kind of work that we need to do to understand how we can learn more about going to other places and planets in the universe. And there are those who believe, and I think I'm one of them, that that's mankind's destiny, is to leave planet Earth and go elsewhere. And that's what we do. We explore.
Yeah, but here's my question. Do we really need venture capital to be leading the way?
Well, it should be government leading the way.
Right. You know,
I agree. But if government doesn't do it, and it's not,
government is not being allowed to do it.
There's this whole thing again of the Republican Party,
right,
which is government can't do anything. And so what they do is, with their incompetence, their mismanagement, and their greed, they make it impossible for government to succeed or function properly. So that being the case, these entrepreneurs are coming in, and there's probably real research. There's probably real development stuff. I mean, the government never did what Elon Musk did with some of his rocket landings, which is to have the rocket descend back to
Earth. They weren't given the opportunity to do it.
Excuse me?
They weren't given the opportunity to do it.
That may be.
You know,
like, but they didn't do it.
But my point is that, look, there is a plaque on the moon left from Apollo 11 that says, "We came in peace for all mankind." I'm sorry. If you go to the moon with Amazon Prime, it's going to be the moon brought to you by Amazon Prime. It's not going to be for all mankind. The altruism is what makes space travel important and also imaginative for me. It's the level of altruism of the science and for the benefaction of all mankind that's there. Not the corporatization of space, right? I mean,
those things concern me. But, you know, Alex, you're probably familiar with Stephen Hawking's thoughts about this, Alex. And then they are that we have to do this because this planet may become despoiled, and it is becoming despoiled.
Right.
But you can't have the scene from the movie Elysium where all the rich people live in space, and then the rest of us have to go through a post-apocalyptic Earth.
That's right. Yeah,
I mean that's what and, where it stands right now. The billionaires can go to space whenever they want,
and they can spend the money to do so because they're getting some pretty massive tax breaks.
Right, right.
There's all of this is true, but time is pushing on, and the need to have this information, and maybe the need to leave the planet is not going to wait.
Well, look, I think we need to have that discussion right now. don't you guys? We need to have a discussion, because do you really want to be the face of space, the guy who comes back on this really oddly shaped capsule and rocket when he comes back and says, "I want to thank every Amazon employee and every American customer because you guys paid for all of this." I don't think I wanted to pay a 57-year-old billionaire for his vanity project to go into space. That's just me. Maybe I have a higher altruism. Joe Biden, I'm okay. Tax me more. Send a scientist to Mars, not Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, but I think this, you know, unfortunately, you're bringing up a lot of problems, or you're bringing up a lot of problems that are the unfortunate result of our bad political system.
Well, that's
and what we need to do.
This is a symptom. It's not a symptom.
You're raging against these individuals rather than looking at the real problem.
Well, I'll rage against the individuals because there used to be a higher standard to which individuals would hold themselves in this country, particularly.
I don't think it's their fault per se. So.
Well, I do think they need to be.
Part of the solution. They're easy. They're really easy targets. So I'll agree with that.
I think they need to. They need to be part of the solution. And admittedly, I think Bezos, when he came back, giving $200 million to both Van Jones and Jose Andreas, is part of the solution. But that still doesn't feel good when Amazon workers are being worked.
Yeah, I puzzled over what he was trying to say by that. But there's on the front page of the New York Times today, there's a debate with Michio Kaku on should we or should we not contact.
Oh, aliens.
Extraterrestrials.
Oh, yeah. You know
that. And this is not.
Go ahead.
This
go
is
ahead.
Not. This is not without its serious. It sounds like a joke, but I think it's really something to talk about and think about.
Kaku
says no way.
I think it's a good topic to kind of we have about 10 minutes left, 7-10 minutes left in the show. You know, why don't we talk a little bit about that? Your thoughts, Alex. Should we contact the aliens?
If they contact us,
that's right. If they contact us, should we respond?
It would be a huge mistake.
I mean, are they as advanced as we are? Are they more advanced?
Theoretically, they'd probably be more advanced if they were trying to contact us.
Understand the argument, let me explain it. Human history, it actually is useful in understanding what happens when there's a huge differential in technological aptitude between two people when they meet. And he references Cortez and Montezuma. Every time this has happened in human history, the lower technology group is dominated and exploited by the greater technology group. And there's no reason to think that wouldn't happen.
But that happens between people. We're not talking about other humans. Maybe these beings are actually more.
I don't think so. I'm going to say that wherever there are, creatures that are intelligent, they need to take in resources in order to live, in order to do things, in order to be powerful. That's just physics. Those are just the laws of the universe. And so they're going to have needs and they're going to look to see if we can provide them. I don't think we're going to come out on top by that exchange. So I think Kaku is right. And he's not the only person who has indulged in the thought experiments associated with this question. So I think that's pretty reasonable. It's something to avoid pretty much at all costs.
But what if in the future we are that race that happens upon some species that's lesser developed than we are?
We've been doing that for millennia now.
I think we get Avatar.
Alex is right.
We get Avatar, right? We get Avatar. You know, and so.
Well,
so.
Here's what I suggest. Listen, go to the New York Times and Google the name Michio, M-I-C-H-I-O,
Kaku,
K-A-K-U. Well, I'm just telling the audience.
They know so who that he they is.
Can, then you can listen to it'll come up that there's that. It's a podcast that the New York Times does. It's about 40 minutes, and it's really interesting. So that's what I recommend that they do. Because I'm just spouting off here and remembering what I can recall. They're the experts and they're talking about the issues, but that really frames it, that differential in technology as it's utilized. And they begin by talking about the UFOs, and Kaku says that if that's real, they're hugely more advanced than we are.
Well, I prefer the world of Star Trek altruism. That's just me.
Wouldn't we all love that? I think what we would probably see is not so much what you see between interactions between the human race and like the Aztecs and the Spaniards, rather the interactions between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals.
Right.
So we're talking about distinct species, and yeah, there's competition, displacement. Sometimes there's interbreeding. I don't know. I mean, we don't know unless we investigate, and that's part of our nature is to be curious.
Well, there's a film, a science fiction film called The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which the aliens come down and they're here to bring us technology to gift the planet with more knowledge and a greater understanding of the opportunities that the technology presents in terms of interstellar travel and so on and so forth. And mankind, being brutish, attacks. And then out of the flying saucer, in one of the greatest scenes in any science fiction film, directed by, God, what is his name?
We're not talking the Keanu Reeves version, are we?
No, the original version. I met the director. He worked with Orson Welles a long time ago. Anyway, out of it comes the robot Gort. And the scenes of Gort doing his thing are really lovely to behold. But it may be that what happens is not quite Robert the order. Weiss it may be that if the flying saucer lands, Gort will just come out first.
Robert Weiss. That's the director.
Robert Weiss. Thank you. Yeah, that's the guy. He was actually at UCR, and yeah. I met him at UCR. Came to speak. And
cool.
Yeah. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
Okay, you know what? I'm gonna nickname the Cybertruck that you're gonna buy from Elon Musk Gort.
Gort.
Well, actually, I have always thought that it looked like Gort's head. But I'd love to talk about the problems with the Cybertruck in some future with the design of it.
Yeah. Well, you can talk with that. I'm gonna leave that for auto talk. But I mean it is we should definitely when you get it we'll call it Gort. You know that's gonna be.
Well, I've made that comparison actually.
Well, I just remember the three words. Remember the three words. What are they?
Klaatu, Barada, Nikto.
Something that one of my favorite Hammer horror films, Army of Darkness, that Bruce Campbell could not get right in that movie.
That's not a Hammer film. Hammer films are from the 1960s and starred Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
I just remember it was supposed to be a horror film. It didn't.
Oh yeah, what was it called? The Transylvania Express or something like that. That was really cool.
Maybe I'm not sure if that's a Hammer, but film. But anyway, I think we've covered a gamut of topics today.
Well, we're on to our one good thing.
The bottom line is get a vaccination.
But we typically end with our one good
thing. Oh, yes, of course.
Yes. My one good thing, I rewatched some really good films this last week on Amazon Prime. I rewatched Lincoln, which was really awesome and very good. Inspires me for some form of good political leadership eventually. And so both of you know, because it was the rocket launches, I watched the Apollo 11 documentary that came out last year. And that was a really, really awesome documentary. And shows you what, when the national will is willing to do, we can do awesome things like fight a war in Vietnam and send a man to the moon. Try that, Jeff Bezos.
That's very, very good, Tony, that you watch on Amazon Prime.
Exactly.
And now you're criticizing Jeff Bezos. You should be thanking him because he thanked you because you're a customer.
Yeah, I can't live with myself at that point. So how about you, Alex? Man. I know. We can't get away from it. Amazon's everywhere. Well, you're one good thing, Alex.
My good thing is a very good thing, and it's actually very private right now, and I'm not going to share much. I'll keep you posted.
Okay. All right. We won't do anything publicly on the air then.
That's good.
I'm hearing some bells in the distance. Anyway, no, okay. Anyway, so on rival to Jeff Bezos, Netflix, I binged watched their 6-part series called How to Be a Dictator, or How to Be a Tyrant.
Right.
How to Be a Tyrant. And it starts with Hitler, of course, and then there's Saddam Hussein. There's the Kim Jong Il and several other delightful human beings. And so the thing is, and obviously who inspired it, last week we had General Milley come out and say and actually make the comparison. He called the Republicans who invaded the Capitol. He said that they were Nazis, and he said that Trump is a Hitlerian. He preached the gospel of Hitler. So what this series is really about that. And I'm sure it's inspired by the presidency of Donald Trump, because if you watch it and you see this accurate depiction of how these people rose to power, each one is featured a different thing. It's pay off your henchmen, control the media. Use violence. It's all in there, and that's the road that Donald Trump was walking down. And that road is the end of democracy, and that's the end of our lives as we have known them. And maybe in any respect.
The only thing that stopped them was the United States military was not down for that.
Yeah, but it could be in the future.
Right, that's the scary thing.
I will add another good thing that happened last week, and that is the city of Riverside coming together to protest against Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene from holding their hate fest here in our city. So
right, and with that, we are all out of time. So for Alex Cortez and Clark Price, I want to thank you for listening. Tune in next time for more of the happy hour. Goodbye, everyone.
All right. Bye.